Hello, it's Friday, September the 24th, and this is the Andrew Pearce Show, coming as ever from the Daily Mail newsroom. Coming up, over 50s, how you can keep a pretty good head of hair, and it's often a lot to do with not what you put on your hair, but what you eat. Is it a good idea to have a baby at 47? What are the downsides? Fraud is at an all-time record level, more and more people being conned to taking money out of their bank account and giving to fraudsters. The furlough scheme finally coming to an end next week. It's cost around £70 billion. What impact is it going to have on the jobs market? But first, the Sussexes, they're back, photographed in an engagement in New York. Have you missed them? I certainly haven't. Harry and Meghan, they're back in their first major public appearance since they effectively walked away from the royal family this year. The Sussex were treated like royalty in New York City with a private site visit and a meeting with the US ambassador to the United Nations. I'm joined by Angela Levin, the royal biographer, and of course she's author of Harry, Conversations with the Prince. Well, Angela, the crowds turned out, the cameras were there. What did you make of their first official visit, trip? Call it what you will.
I thought it was cringe-making. It's extraordinary because Harry and Meghan didn't like going on royal engagements, which is one of the reasons why they quitted, and now they're doing it. Harry said in when they were in South Africa in November that he couldn't bear photographers and clicks. Every time he heard a click of the camera, he felt he was taken back to his mother's death. He couldn't bear it. There he was, smiling at the camera as they went with a personal photographer. They didn't risk any old person doing it. Here we have the hypocrisy. They're driving around in SUVs, which are huge, hugely bad for the environment. Three of them are taking them around with blacked out windows. Everything they do is to tell us what we must do, but they don't want to do it themselves. But why on earth is the United States pandering to all that? Surely the ambassador of the UN has got better things to do than to tell Harry and Meghan what's going on. In any case, they could have done this with a Zoom call. Why are they, is the mayor spending time doing it? They're not royals. They don't have any control about doing anything except lecturing us. I find it just absolutely astonishing.
And I suspect, Angela, this is probably going to be the first of many, don't you?
Yes, I think, well, I have felt for a while now that they want to present themselves as a woke, modern royal family to give us all an alternative. I think they're very, very pleased to sort of bring what we know as our royal family down, and they will continue to attack them and be aggressive towards them and unkind and put themselves as an alternative. I can't see why they're doing that. They're not there to actually represent the royal family in the UK. They're not there. They've got no power. They're not scientists. They're not virologists. But yet they feel that they have the right to present themselves as superheroes.
Yeah, and of course they're pressing for more COVID vaccines to be presented or to be distributed in countries where the vaccine take-up is low. Do you think they were effectively having a dig at Britain? Because although we are going to give away 100 million vaccines, there has been some criticism in some quarters that we shouldn't be doing booster jabs in Britain, Angela, before we've distributed vaccines to countries in Africa. Not a view I hold, by the way.
No, nor me, but I think that's absolutely right. They're going to this One World Observatory where they've talked before, and they are going to discuss this. Well, they're not informed enough to do that. We even had our Prime Minister listening to the scientists on actually the detail of vaccination. But here they go, speaking very carefully made up and very carefully dressed. It's a whole palaver. It's a real sort of acting, isn't it? It's like being in a film where they're going along and they're talking about what should really happen. But the reality is they've got no idea about all these things. I mean, like a lot of us, all of us don't quite understand, should we, shouldn't we have another vaccine? Should we go out? Should we stay in? Should we wear masks? You know, it's querying the most intelligent of people, not saying that that's me, but it is difficult to know how to manage it, but they feel they've got the right to tell the world what should be done.
Yeah, and I wonder if they've been double jabbed and are going to have booster jabs, Angela. Of course, we won't know that.
We won't know that because that would be an invasion of their privacy, but it doesn't matter if they invade the royal family's privacy, like the Queen and Prince Charles. That's fine. It's just, it mustn't happen to them.
And I'm just going to ask you just finally, there was that fabulous programme the other night, the tribute to Prince Philip by members of the royal family.
Yes.
I wonder what he's making of all this from his celestial position up there somewhere, looking down. What do you think he makes of Harry and Meghan?
Well, I think he would be absolutely furious and disappointed with them for their behaviour and for their disrespect to his beloved wife, the Queen. No doubt about it.
And we still haven't seen a photograph of Lilibet, have we?
No, not at all. That I don't mind. If she wants to keep her quiet, that's fine to me. But what I do mind is them telling everybody else what to do. And actually, Harry's comment during that marvellous documentary was, the Queen, his grandmother and his grandfather, they were an adorable couple. Well, adorable is a word you use for tiny children, isn't it? It's very patronising to use it to Her Majesty the Queen. I thought that was terrible. And he most felt sad because of her loss. Okay, so then he keeps on challenging her. He's doing a programme with Oprah Winfrey while his grandfather is seriously ill in hospital and he knew he was going to die within the next few weeks. It's all nothing. It doesn't make up. But a lot of people obviously just take them for what they're doing, the superficial side of them. And I just, and even when you've got UN representatives doing the same thing, I mean, it's absolutely, I can't understand why they can't see through the mask.
Well, very interesting, Angela, as ever. That's Angela Levin. She's the royal biographer and author of the fascinating book, Harry, Conversations with the Prince. Visit mailplus.co.uk/subscribe to get access to all our podcasts, our videos, opinion pieces, and much more. If you want to get in touch, tweet us at mailplus or me at Tory Boy Pierce. The government's furlough scheme is finally coming to an end. Next Thursday, 30th of September, it's thought still more than a million people are still claiming furlough cash from the government. Since it launched last March, furlough has supported 11.6 million jobs, paying up to 80% of people's wages at a cost of a staggering nearly £70 billion to the taxpayer. But what's going to happen to the job market when the furlough scheme finally comes to an end? I'm joined now by James Reid of the Reid Employment Agency. Mr. Reid, it's been probably the most expensive job support scheme in the history of the British Isles. What happens the week after next?
Well, it's a very good question, Andrew, and without doubt it has. But I do think it was a really inspired thing to do because it saved a huge number of jobs. And a lot of people were expecting unemployment to go to 15%, you know, Great Depression levels last year, which it did not do. And it's now down as low as 4.75%. So I think at the end of September, we will see unemployment rise, regrettably, but I hope by not too much, because although, you know, as you just said, up to a million people are going to be coming off furlough, there are a huge number of vacancies at the moment. So I hope that, you know, a lot of those people will be able to pick up new jobs if they've been unlucky and lost the job they had before.
Do you think some people, some companies will have kept people on furlough knowing that the government is paying the wages and then will release them at the end of the furlough period because they're in no financial position to take on the burden of paying their wages, their national insurance?
That's a risk. I think it is, yes. I mean, I'm sort of asking myself, why would someone still be on furlough this late after the pandemic began? You know, it's 18 months ago, isn't it? So it must be because the sectors they were in have been very badly hit and the companies they've been in a very badly hit or haven't got back on their feet very successfully. So a lot of those companies were probably hoping to be able to re-engage people and maybe they some still will be able to, but it seems likely that a lot won't. Yeah.
And what of the jobs market? We keep reading there's potentially up to 1 million vacancies, which is a record. Why is that so?
The jobs market has changed really rapidly this year, and it began in May, really. We started seeing huge numbers of jobs come onto our website on Reed, and this began what I've called a jobs boom, and many more jobs than we were really expecting. We expected things to pick up. And this has gained momentum because the economy has really come out of the traps pretty quickly and is growing fast. And everyone, you know, all these companies that had been sort of very careful with their money now want to expand and grow again, and they want to hire more people. So we're seeing it right across the economy. All regions of the country and all sectors are hiring at the moment. And that's putting pressure on wages. So wages are going up, which is good news for people coming into the job market if they are leaving furlough. Wages are going up and there are more opportunities. So I hope those people who've been furloughed for a long time and are worried about it ending aren't feeling too demoralized, because there are opportunities and many of them are good ones.
And are there jobs that it's just going to be very difficult to fill? I'm thinking of people who work on farms, picking crops, picking fruit. I'm thinking of people in the hospitality industry. We know that after Brexit, quite a lot of people from Eastern Europe who provided a cheaper source of labour have returned to their homes. They also probably returned to their homes because with the pandemic kicking in, they didn't want to be trapped here.
Yeah, I mean, those jobs are harder to fill, that's right. And what we're seeing is the pay rates on those jobs are going up quite rapidly as companies are competing for the people who might be interested in doing them. And you know, we've seen this very dramatically in the shortage of drivers, and particularly HGV drivers. There just simply aren't enough drivers to meet the demand. And this isn't just happening in the UK, this is happening across Europe. So it suggests a big change in the labour market. And it's really quite significant because I think the workforce has got smaller. You know, the pandemic accelerated a lot of changes. One of those changes is the workforce became smaller. A lot of people who are older decided to retire or they've had enough. A lot of people left, as you said, to other parts of the world. And people decided to do different things. So the workforce is smaller now. And there are fewer people available to do these jobs. And that will have all sorts of consequences across the economy.
And you're in a prime position. Do you know that you will be able to, that vacancies will be able to be filled? Or do you think there's going to have to be some form of temporary visa scheme, perhaps, to get some people back from Eastern Europe or beyond to fill some of those jobs which are not as well paid? And even though the pay is going up, they're still not very well paid.
I think all options should be considered because it's a crime, isn't it, to leave crops rotting in fields and to leave goods undelivered, you know, when they're for important purposes. And I think, you know, all options should be considered. I'm not in government, but I would certainly be looking at what might be done to mitigate that. There might be all sorts of schemes and some creative thinking around this that could be very helpful. But, you know, above all, I think, you know, a lot of our young people are going to university, many to do subjects that aren't particularly practical, and not enough young people are being trained to do the jobs that need to be done. And so this is a problem in a sense that's been a long time coming and that we've been making for ourselves. And I think that whole, you know, what should we expect from education and how can we help people progress into their working life successfully should be reconsidered, really. And that's going to take a bit of time.
Yeah, just finally, I know when I was at school, Mr. Reed, the apprenticeship was king. Rather went out of fashion now, but it's coming back more into fashion, isn't it? And perhaps that's something to be supported and applauded.
I think apprenticeship's incredibly important. Yeah, and the problem was when they introduced the apprenticeship levy, which had been intended to expand apprenticeships, it had, unfortunately, the opposite effect, and fewer companies were doing apprenticeships because they felt they were paying twice. So regrettably, the number of people doing apprenticeships has been declining for the past 5 years. But if anything should change as a result of this pandemic and this crisis, it's that apprenticeships should be put right back on the front of the agenda and made widely available for young people and supported, you know, by business, by government, and by the trade unions.
Indeed. Let's all support that. That's James Reed, who is of Reed Employment Agency. Thanks for joining us. Visit mailplus.co.uk to listen to The Andrew Pearce Show for free and in full, along with our other podcasts and video series. Remember to tell your Alexa speaker to play Daily Mail News. So fraudsters are now stealing £2 million a day in Britain, and fraud cases have spiked by 30% in a year during this wretched pandemic. In total, 753 million stolen in the first half of this year alone, a rise of a third on the same period last year. I'm joined now by Tony Blake. He's head of stakeholder engagement at the dedicated card and payment crime unit. Tony, these figures are staggering, and it seems the police or the authorities are not really able to do much about it.
Well, there's actually a lot going on, and yes, they are staggering figures, and yes, they are a huge increase, but there is actually a lot going on right at this moment.
What's going on then? Because a lot of this money it's the bank transfer scams that are now higher, I think, than credit and debit card fraud, where people are being tricked to sending money to criminals.
That's right, yeah. We call them authorised push payment fraud, but effectively, you're right, it's where the customer themselves have been tricked into making a payment they believed is going somewhere else or on behalf of something else, and they're tricked into making it. So someone rings up, pretends to be the bank or the police or any other sort of large corporation or agency that most of us are involved with. A lot of us will have had those calls or emails or text messages. In fact, probably most of us have, most adults have. And yes, that's the one that's up. And what's sort of been happening over recent years, particularly around the pandemic, is they have been targeting us, the customers. They are having far less joy with targeting our banks or credit card issuers. So they have moved tact, and they are now targeting us, the customers, in all sorts of ways. We talked about phone or email or text message. It doesn't matter how they try, they will keep trying, and they'll try and convince us they are who they say they are in order to do it.
We've got this figure of 753.9 million, Tony, but it could be a lot higher, couldn't it? Because some people perhaps don't even know they've been defrauded or don't tell us they've been defrauded.
There are certainly people that that don't report it to the police, but I think in the majority of cases, people will report it to their bank or their card issuer. There may be some reasons why they don't.
Yeah.
They feel embarrassed or whatever. But I think in the main, people will report it to their bank or their card issuers. And the figures that were released, these are the figures that are from the banking industry.
Now, you said a lot's going on. What is going on to try to stop these wretched people?
Well, first and foremost, the banks have got put in and spent billions on different systems in order to try and prevent all sorts of different types of fraud going on. Again, that's why they're targeting the customer. So it's around education, but more importantly, it's around engagement with others outside of the banking industry who have a stake and are stakeholders, if you like, in it. So if you look at the sort of problem-solving analogy, if you look at problem-solving, you have to engage with everybody who has a footprint in that problem. Mm. And that, in this particular case, yes, it is the social media companies, it is the tech industry generally, it's the mobile phone industry, it's telecoms industry, all have a part to play in helping to prevent this. Because, you know, certainly the banking industry cannot do it alone. And if you look at something like text message scams, then the vast majority of that, it's coming from other people. Until the money is transferred, it's coming from other people. And if the money is transferred from a genuine customer, the bank will look at that. And if it's particularly if it's done on a mobile device or an internet banking, they'll look at that and they'll say, this is our genuine customer, because they're using an IP address that we know they use all the time. It's a device that we know they use all the time. And therefore, we'll allow that payment to go through because we're happy that's our genuine customer. And that's how the fraudsters are working now. It's a collaborative. It really has to be a collaborative approach. And government is, you know, there was the tech industry was in front of the Treasury Select Committee yesterday. That's Wednesday. They're in charge in front of them, and government are now pulling in all these different different agencies and companies that have a part to play, and they're bringing them in, and that's only fairly recently, but that's really encouraging, I think.
What's the most important advice you can give to someone? I mean, I had someone telling me that they wanted some money from me to pay for a package or something from the Royal Mail. I didn't believe a word of it. Of course I didn't. But what is your advice to people?
Now, what I always used to say was, if you get something out of the blue that you're not expecting, and they're particularly trying to panic you or rush you, pressurise you into doing something, then alarm bells should be ringing. It's all part of the Take Five to Stop Fraud campaign, which all of the banks and law enforcement are fully behind. And you'll see that the messaging there is stop, challenge, protect. So stop, take a moment to think. You know, the amount of people that I've spoken to over the years that said, you know what, as soon as I put the phone down, or as soon as I press send on that text message or on that email, I thought, oh, what have I done? You know, should I have done that? Are they really who they say they are? And it's really simple when you think about it, but taking a bit of time, and in some cases actually speaking to a family member, a friend, a relative, and saying, I just had this text message asking me to pay £1.99. They'll go, oh, that's a scam. Everyone's seen that. Just doing something simpler, say, rather than just going, well, I was expecting a parcel. Oh, it must be it. I'll pay the £1.99. That's not much. But yeah, it's not much, but what you're actually being asked to give is all your details, all your bank details, your card number, the three-digit number on the back, and then they go spending on your card. So it's really simple. Stop. Challenge it. Is this really who it says it is? This person really says it is? Verify it by a trusted source. So get in touch with that organisation by a number or by the email, by their website, which you know is genuine, and that's the safest way. And if you do end up being a victim of fraud, then you think you might have been, or you think you might have given your details away, then get in touch with your bank, your card issuer immediately, and report it to Action Fraud.
Very good advice. That's Tony Blake, who's head of stakeholder engagement at the Dedicated Card and Payment Crime Unit. Thanks for joining us. So how do you cope when you have a baby at the tender age of 47. Laura Biggs is the owner of Intuitive Events, which organises fertility and menopause events, and ended up having a 15-year-old son and a toddler at the same time after she fell pregnant at 47 using a donor egg. She joins me now. So Laura, you're in that position where you're mother to a 15-year-old, so you're probably helping him with his GCSEs, and at the same time, potty training a 2-year-old.
Yes, I am. How did that happen?
Yeah, and so you've got you're juggling the whole time.
Yeah, I am juggling, and it's bizarre, because obviously the difference, juxtaposition between the two of them is immense. You know, you've got a teenager who's wants to play FIFA and go out with his mates, and pull away from the family ties, and the other one who's completely dependent, and you're going back to potty training when you're having chats about, you know, sex and alcohol. It's a different set of parenting skills.
Of course. Now, you'd had your 15-year-old. Had you, if I'm not being too personal, had you tried to have another child and you just didn't succeed, which is why you then used a donor egg?
Yeah, we tried for 10 years.
Right.
And had 3 rounds of IVF and sadly a miscarriage in between.
Ah.
So we'd had a good go at it, and kind of decided when I was 43 that I'd passed my fertility years, really, and decided not to try again, because it's, you know, for anyone who knows, it's a tough process to go through, and very emotional and tough on your body as well.
Yes.
And then I run the fertility show, and the fertility show, we have lots of seminars around different routes to parenthood, and, you know, got to hear about egg donation a little bit more, which essentially allows you, if you're an older woman, to have a baby, because you use basically a younger woman's egg.
Yeah. And what age do you think realistically, Laura, a woman could have a baby with a donor egg? I mean, how much older could a woman be, do you think?
Well, biologically, you can have a baby with a donor egg at any age.
Right.
Now, that doesn't make it right, because obviously, you know, we're meant to be around to bring up our children,
yes,
and be
exactly.
able to look after them well. Most clinics will give you a cutoff of 50.
Right.
Some of them have extended it now because obviously of COVID and lockdown and age and so on. And others will treat it as if you are still having periods, then essentially you could, in theory, fall pregnant naturally, therefore you can have a baby. I mean, I was a mother at 35 and I'm a mother now at 50 to a 2.5-year-old. And don't get me wrong, I don't have the energy that I had when I was 35, but I have the wisdom.
Yes.
And years of kind of parenting and obviously seeing the different stages. So, you know, it's not for everybody. It's not ideal. I didn't kind of plan when I was in my 20s that I'd be a mother at 47. There's lots of good sides about it, but obviously there's the downsides, you know, that you are older and you haven't got as much energy to run around the playground.
And what about it, Laura? People listening to this, they might, because your fertility show this year is online, I think, from September the 24th, and you have your Let's All Talk Menopause webinars. But would you say to women who, like you, maybe 45 and still haven't had a baby, that they should consider using a donor egg?
Yeah, it's not for everybody. And you have to get your head around the fact that biologically the baby isn't yours. Albeit that you've carried the baby and you've given birth. For me, and this is my personal opinion, and I think everybody has to have to feel okay about it. It took me a little while to get into that space, but it's a gift. It's an absolute gift, you know, for somebody to give an egg is true, you know, very, very generous, because it's a process that they have to go through. And it's quite laborious. But for me, it's given me the gift of motherhood that I was desperate for. And, you know, 10 years of trying, anyone who's tried for a baby for any length of time and has not succeeded with their own fertility because of various reasons, then it is a route to parenthood that can. And I, and, you know, having a biological and a non-biological child, I feel no different about them.
That was the final thing I was going to ask you, Laura. So Isabella was conceived through the egg donor. Do you feel exactly the same about her as you do about your 15-year-old boy?
I do. Exactly the same. There's no difference at all. And, you know, you hear that with people that adopt children, have their own children as well. I mean, that's probably a clunky choice of words there.
Yeah.
But biological children. I absolutely feel no different. In fact, I feel intrigued about Isabella because obviously there's part of her personality and her genetics that we don't know. But she's fascinating. And, yeah, she's an absolute gift as far as I'm concerned, and you know, the science and technology that allow you to be a mother later in life and to be able to do that is incredible.
Fascinating article, and really fascinating to talk to you here on the podcast, Laura. So best of luck with you and your kids, and best of luck with the fertility show, which is online from September the 24th for 3 days. Really nice to talk to you. Is it really possible to have a fab head of hair at 50 and beyond? Well, the hairdresser Andrew Barton is an expert in using scissors to turn back the clock on the Channel 4 series 10 Years Younger. He warns that hair can become dull and lackluster as you get older, but he has tips on how to bring your hair back to life. And he joins me now. Now, Andrew, I'm over 50, and I have famously once had vitamins injected into my scalp to try to stop my hair disappearing. And it's not disappearing fast, but it is disappearing. What should I do?
Wow. Well, not only do we share the same name, Andrew, but we share the same issue as well. I'm over 50 and I lost my hair in my early mid-30s. But
did
I've
you?
Had to learn how to deal with that. But of course, in my headmaster salon in Mayfair, I'm faced with this challenge all the time, that so many clients are aware of how their density of their hair changes, not just men, but in particularly women.
Right.
And we see that change happening as early as a woman's a younger age, in her early 30s, that the density starts to change. And what that means, Andrew, and for the listeners, is that she starts to see some quite dramatic changes in her hair, including not only colour change, but it's feeling thinner and finer and less easy to style, which is kind of one of the biggest issues that clients face.
Mm. So what solutions do you recommend so our hair becomes not so dull, not so lackluster, and perhaps even stop it thinning?
Well, before we go on to solutions,
yeah,
let's just have a look at kind of how it all starts.
Right.
Because not only is the aging process part of it, but also that's encouraged then by the effects of menopause, you know, the effects of pollution, stress, and particularly stress that we've seen over the last 2 years through the pandemic. And then also some of the medications that people start to take as they mature, as not necessary illnesses, but there's changes happening in the body. So sometimes medications are involved to help some of those problems, but then create other problems, which can often lead to hair loss or that kind of change in density in the hair. So some of it is about these natural processes that happen. Some of it's about these more unnatural kind of processes that are happening. But some of the small changes what we can definitely do every day is look at the power of nutrition and our diet,
right,
and how we can feed our hair healthy.
Right. So how do you do that?
Well, some of it is really based, I mean, I'm not a nutritionist, but I do know from having worked with nutritionists in the past, and some of my clients are nutritionists, that the hair and scalp is particularly benefited by a diet rich in protein and fiber.
Right.
So eating, for example, a lot of oily fish, fresh fruit, whole grains and vegetables are all going to add to those essential vitamins and minerals that the body needs to create the healthy roof, if you like, for hair growth, which is the scalp, and feeds the hair follicle, which is where the blood supply feeds the follicle to make for healthier hair growth.
Right. So diet is one thing. What about washing our hair, Andrew? Should we wash it less often? If we keep washing it, does that take some of the good bits out of the scalp and the hair, or not? Does that make no difference?
No. I mean, I love breaking down some of those old wise tales,
yeah,
that, you know, people often think that by leaving their hair, the natural oils are going to nourish their,
yes,
hair. In fact, those natural oils will only travel an inch or so down the hair length,
right,
and then we'll just look like greasy, oily roots, you know,
oh,
and that you've not cared for your hair at
not
all.
Not nice.
And I often think as well, remember, when we're washing and cleansing our hair, we're not only washing the hair, but most importantly, we're washing the scalp, which is just an extension of the skin on the rest of the body.
Yeah.
And you're taking your face and your body to all kinds of places every single day.
Mm.
So I'm an advocate for cleansing that scalp often, at least once a day. But I know for a lot of women, particularly if they've got a lot of hair that involves a lot of styling maintenance, then that's not always practical.
Right.
But yes, I mean, cleansing is very important. And one of my biggest tips and advice, pieces of advice, is when we do wash our hair and scalp, spend a few more precious minutes doing that when you're in the shower.
Right.
It's one of those things that we're always in a busy rush. We're always trying to do things speedily. But by spending a little bit more time cleansing and using those luxurious suds of a great shampoo on the hair and scalp, it will make a big difference to kind of the care of kind of the overall look.
Do you know what, Andrew? I think we should send Boris Johnson to see you, because I can tell you, I've been up close to Boris Johnson. He's losing that distinctive mane of blonde hair. It's thinning rapidly. Thinning rapidly. So what do you think you could do for Boris?
Oh, do you know what? I think I did comment just recently on an article in the Daily Mail about Boris's hair. And I think part of Boris's hair is his signature. We all,
yeah,
know him for it.
Exactly.
And I think actually it's been a bit of a purposeful signature as well. I'm sure he does it on purpose.
I've seen him mess it up. I've seen him mess it up and then go out in front of the cameras.
Andrew, I've been there. I've seen it as well.
Exactly.
Oh, yes.
We're giving away trade secrets there.
We are.
Great to talk to you. That's Andrew Barton, Headmasters, Creative and Communications Director. And of course, you see him on that Channel 4 series, 10 Years Younger.
That's all we've got time for today. For the latest from the Daily Mail, download the Mail Plus app every weekday at 5 p.m. You can listen to me all over again. I'm Andrew Pearce. This is The Andrew Pearce Show. I'll be back on Monday. Have yourselves a great weekend and good night.